From movie set to multiplex, it's the business of film with James Cameron Wilson.
Jerry, don't let us ask for the moon. We have the stars.
I'm Spartacus!
I'm Spartacus!
To infinity and beyond!
We may not go quite that far, but we are going to be looking at last week's box office winners and losers with James Cameron Wilson in the business of film. So, James, what is top of the UK box office?
No surprises, really, considering how much money it's making around the world. We are talking about Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. Now, the first Guardians of the Galaxy racked up £28.5 million in total at the UK box office. The new one, which opened only the previous weekend, already has over £27.4 million in its pocket. And it's already the fifth highest grossing movie of the year so far, after Beauty and the Beast, La La Land, Sing, and Fast and Furious 8. In fact, overall, the UK box office is up 18%. On 2016 at the same benchmark. So it's doing really, really well. It is popcorn entertainment time and people are streaming into the cinemas. But I have to say, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 is an absolute hoot. I'm not an enormous fan of superhero movies or intergalactic escapades, but I did think this one was funny. Every bit as good as the first one. And it's, I think the deadpan delivery really helps. It's a very funny movie. The plot is totally irrelevant. Just go with these bizarre characters knocking off these one-liners. I absolutely loved it. Well, and it was great in 3D.
It looks as if it's going to be... Oh, OK, so a movie that actually improved by 3D. That doesn't often happen, I don't feel.
Well, visually, it is very smart. Okay. Let's just say that.
I shall try. Because the irritating thing was, you go and see a movie, then you realise it's 3D, then you realise you've forgotten one of the 30 pairs of 3D glasses that you've already bought at home. I did once try seeing a Transformers movie. I was so grumpy that I went along not realising there'd only be 3D versions. I didn't want to pay extra for the glasses because I had so many, and I thought, it's Transformers, you know, I don't really like it anyway, I don't want to give them the extra money. And of course, watching a 3D film without the 3D glasses gives you something of a headache, I confess. So I will take my 3D glasses with me when I go and see it, though I still have yet to see the first one again, and I feel, you know, as we've already discussed, that I ought to see that before I see the second to remind myself. But it sounds good fun.
Really.
It's going to be... but I'd quite like to. I'd quite like to remind myself of it. It's not going to be a real hardship, I'm sure, James. OK, so Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 is at number one. What is at number two?
Well, considering the logjam of popcorn blockbusters, I didn't see this happening. Still, it just goes to show that counter-programming does work and that a film with a dog and Dennis Quaid can actually make money. £1.3 million, no less. Although not to pour cold water on Dennis Quaid's box office muscle, A Dog's Purpose did benefit from a lot of previews, 463 to be exact. And it was available in 502 kennels nationwide compared to, say, the 96 screens that unveiled the new film Mindhorn, more of which later. But is A Dog's Purpose any good? Well, may I advise prospective cinema goers that if you don't like dogs, don't bother. I love dogs and I wish I hadn't bothered. Yeah, I cried, but then I always do at dog movies. The problem is the format of the film and the leap of faith one is expected to make. In a nutshell, Josh Gad is the voice of a dog who keeps on dying, being born, being weaned, and ending up with new owners. All, remarkably, as it happens, in the same country, which I thought was extraordinary. For all the research I've done in reincarnation, I was really surprised that the dog kept on popping up back in the United States. So at least there's no language.
It's where all the aliens invade. They never go anywhere else.
You reckon?
Well, okay, but they're
very
mostly
fond.
Centered
they're very
on the United States.
So a belief in destiny and reincarnation is mandatory if one is to swallow the premise. And it would help if we believed in the canine capacity to see the world as we see it, albeit, of course, fine-tuned by its nose. Unlike last year's portmanteau comedy drama Wiener Dog, a not entirely dissimilar confection, this adaptation of W. Bruce Cameron's novel takes the same dog through a series of chapters with different owners. The difference here is that the film is aimed at the tear ducts and the poor pooch keeps on dying. The dog, though, is a philosopher, Simon, a canine soul perplexed by the reason for being. Mm-hmm. What is the meaning of life, he wonders, before being taken off to the dog pound to die? The stop-start format never works well in filmic terms, with the viewer hurled from one emotional showdown to the next without the actual satisfaction of getting to know any of the characters. And Dennis Quaid himself doesn't appear till the very end. I was really annoyed by Rachel Portman's music. She does really wring the tear ducts. I like Britt Robertson, who was in a wonderful film called The Space Between Us earlier. But again, this actress is 27. And if I see her play another schoolgirl, I shall scream. It's not a great film. It's not a great film. It has its moments. It just doesn't work. It didn't work for me.
I can't help thinking that Lasse Hallström, the director, has not sort of fulfilled the promise of his early films. But what's very peculiar about it, when I think about it, is the number of films that have had dog in the title. There was a film with Richard Gere that I didn't see called Hashir Dog's Tale that apparently was quite good. But, of course, the film that brought him to our attention was My Life as a Dog.
That is... I hadn't even thought of that.
So, gosh, you're and then he, right. Then he made things like What's Eating Gilbert Grape, which I thought was fantastic. Then things I wasn't quite so sure about, like Chocolat and the Cider House Rules. But, I mean, more recently, I quite like Salmon Fishing in the Yemen. I don't think you did. But then, you know, 100-Foot Journey was his last film, which I thought, even though it had a script by Stephen Knight, wasn't particularly good.
So, I did actually quite like that one.
Oh, did you? Oh, well, there we are. Yeah. Disagree on that one. I think that's available on... sort of streaming services, because I saw part of it just the other day. Well, that's number two, A Dog's Purpose, if you're into dogs and you're into reincarnation and you can cope with the implausibilities even within the reincarnation story, that's obviously for you. So what is number three?
Well, we have a couple of new films we need to talk about and a DVD. So I'm going to fly through the ones I've already reviewed. But number three, which I thought was going to be at number two, Fast and Furious 8, which is breaking box office records around the world. Not so much so in this country, for some reason, even though Jason Statham and Helen Mirren are in it. I think this is the best of the franchise. I absolutely loved it. It's amazing. Anyway, number four, we've got The Boss Baby holding extraordinarily well with £25.6 million in the bank. And $440 million worldwide. It's the fourth highest grossing film that Alec Baldwin has ever been associated with, including Madagascar Escape to Africa, in which he had the smaller vocal part of Makunga the Lion. I suppose this is his most successful film to date, as he's got the lead voice, which is the Boss Baby. Number five, we have Beauty and the Beast, which I loved, with the live action version of Disney's huge animated classic. And we have a new film at number six. Do we have time to talk about it, or should we have a break?
No, let's talk about it.
Okay, this film is called Sleepless. It's a lean, mean action thriller starring Jamie Foxx as a corrupt Vegas cop. That's all you really need to know, other than it's extremely fast-paced, and there's really no time for any character development. Of course, this might not come as a huge surprise to many listeners, except what struck me about the film is that it's directed by Baron Bo Odar. He is a Swiss filmmaker, and his first picture was a very leisurely, if horribly shocking and daring film called The Silence, with nothing but character development. In short, The Silence dared to take an entirely taboo subject matter, paedophilia, and look at it from the perspective of the perpetrator. In the last 10 years, it's one of the few foreign language films that has refused to go away from my head, up there with the French Police and the Danish The Hunt. And it's extraordinary that Baran Bo Odar should go from The Silence to this film, which is completely the opposite. It's such a different film. Jamie Foxx, who plays Vince Downs, hasn't gone to sleep, hasn't time to sleep or drink or eat. And when he does go to the loo, it's to stash 25K of cocaine in a ceiling panel. I quite like the idea that Jamie Foxx is playing an anti-hero. He's a corrupt cop. We don't like him at the beginning. The film has a few sort of perfunctory establishing shots of Vegas and cut straight to the chase, a car chase to be exact. We then have a brutal shootout and we realise what a nasty piece of work Jamie Foxx is. He's not liked by his ex-wife. We do know, or the little sort of backstory we're allowed, that he's got a teenage son, Thomas, and he reluctantly takes Thomas to soccer practice. And having stolen this 25K of cocaine from the dastardly Dermot Mulroney, he is stopped in the car and his son is abducted. And it's then this endless chase to try and get his son back and trying to get the cocaine. And I think it works really well. It actually builds momentum and gets more and more exciting. And I thought it looks like so many films I've seen before. But that the grip really intensified on me. And there is a good guy. The really good guy is Michelle Monaghan, who's an agent from Internal Affairs, who is not only fighting to prove that Vince Downs is a loose cannon, but also the institutionalized sexism of her department. And there is a terrific villain. I did like the hierarchy of villainy. You come to one sort of scumbag and you can't believe there's a guy further up the chain that he's terrified of, and that guy is terrified of somebody else. Mm-hmm. But the ultimate villain is played by Scoot McNairy, who's a sort of bitter and twisted son of a mobster, and is perhaps the most vile villain of the year to date. I really enjoyed this. It's a B-movie. It's a sort of Saturday night movie, but for me, it works, and Jamie Foxx, boy, can he move. He can protect himself.
Okay, James, well, thank you very much indeed. That's number six of the box office. We'll be back in a moment to find out what's number seven.
From movie set to multiplex, it's the business of film with James Cameron Wilson.
We are talking the business of film with James Cameron Wilson. So, James, we've got to number seven in last weekend's box office chart. What's that?
Yeah, this is doing really well. This is a film called Their Finest. It's a British movie that you absolutely loved.
I did.
About a group of filmmakers making a propaganda film in 1940 about Dunkirk with Gemma Arterton, Sam Claflin and Bill Nighy. Everybody I know and a lot of people I know have gone out to see this film and they've all loved it. And I appear to be in a minority along with The Guardian newspaper. Not that I felt it was a bad film, but one that I just couldn't believe in for a minute. I didn't believe in Gemma Arterton's accent. I didn't believe in the backdrops. I just didn't feel a real sense of place or time. But I was very engaged by it on a fairly superficial level. And in fact, it's funny because I was so intrigued by The Blitz, I went and saw another film on DVD this weekend called Mrs. Miniver.
Oh, yes, Greer Garson gave the longest ever Oscar acceptance speech.
5 minutes.
Yes, that's right. After that, they started restricting it, yes.
Yeah, and she still holds the record for the most Oscar nominations consecutively, 5 as Best Actress.
Wow.
Nobody has overtaken Greer Garson. And, of course, her great nephew is doing very well at the moment, Jamie Dornan. But I digress. Mrs. Miniver, oh, I found it so moving. And in fact, funnily enough, that was made in 1942 and was a propaganda film, albeit made entirely in Hollywood. Mm. But we will be talking about shortly another film made in 1942, also set during the war. But moving on, at number eight, we have a new film called Mindhorn, starring Julian Barrett, who plays Richard Thorncroft, who used to be Mindhorn, who was a TV detective who could see the truth with the help of his robotic eye.
We have a clip.
Communist doctors performed experimental cybernetic surgery upon him. They removed his eye and replaced it with a super-advanced optical lie detector, which meant he could literally see the truth. He escaped Russia and returned home to the Isle of Man. Bruce Mindhorn became the best plainclothes detective the Isle of Man had ever seen.
Now, that's saying something. So, James, this is one I suspect that you haven't had a chance to see.
Well, no, it hasn't had a very wide release. Richard Thorncroft is he's now a washed-up actor doing awful commercials when the police approach him to negotiate with a serial killer who will only talk to Mindhorn because he believes that Mindhorn was a real character. The actor sees it as an opportunity to relaunch his career. And, of course, it's all played very broadly for laughs. I gather the film, I think the kindest reviews have said that it would have made a good sort of half hour short. But unfortunately, they drag it out to much longer than that.
I do have friends who are something of cineasts who would often be going to see the most highbrow of movies, and they went to it and seemed to have a reasonably good time. They were waxing lyrical, but that may be, they may just have a very peculiar sense of humour.
Well, I did see a clip of it and I thought, no, this is not for me. It's way over the top. But nice to see sort of Kenneth Branagh playing himself.
OK, so that is Mindhorn, which is number 8. What have we got at number 9?
We've got another new film at number 9 called Unlocked, another Let's Get London disaster movie in which the capital becomes the target of a terrorist attack, but this time far more deadly than anything dreamed up by Khalid Massoud. This time it's biological. A good cast includes Noomi Rapace, Orlando Bloom, Toni Collette, John Malkovich, and Michael Douglas, under the direction of none other than Michael Apted.
Wow.
I know. I still think he's probably best remembered for, what, Gorillas in the Mist?
I guess so. World Is Not Enough. I'm trying to think what else he did.
Well,
did
the Bond movie,
and,
yeah,
and those sort of documentaries on television, of course, what, Seven Up and or whatever it was.
Yes,
21
right.
Up and
yeah,
all those
yes,
those things, which are still going, as far as I'm aware. I rather liked Nell that he made
with Jodie Foster.
With Jodie
and
Foster.
Liam Neeson.
Yes, long time ago. I haven't seen it. It's probably one of those films that I liked enormously the first time, and if I saw it again, perhaps I wouldn't as much. But
I really liked
intriguing.
His Amazing Grace. I'm just putting that out.
I'm
there.
Trying to remember what that was. Oh, it I know. Was, that was also another film by Stephen Knight. That was about the abolition of slavery guy, Wilberforce.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. William Wilberforce. And the British Prime Minister was his great friend, Pitt, played by a young actor that nobody'd heard of called Benedict Cumberbatch.
Yes, he vanished without trace afterwards, I'm sure.
Okay.
So,
in fact, he was promoting the film when Ben and I had breakfast together at the same hotel we were staying in. Anyway, at number 10, we've got the Hindi version of Bahub Ali, The Conclusion, which is a very long action-adventure filmed in Hyderabad in India. It is the sequel, and probably, judging by the title of The Conclusion, the last we'll be hearing of it. It's been released in a number of different versions, including Tamil, which also did pretty well in the UK. And it's extraordinary that it had two different language versions in the top 10 last week, and it's still hanging on there at number 10 this week.
Hmm. Right. Anything you want to look at below the chart? I know sometimes you find interesting things. I noticed much lower in the chart, number 21, I think, Whiskey Galore, which is a remake, but clearly is doing absolutely dreadfully and will vanish very quickly. I'm never quite sure why people would want to remake really classic movies anyway, Whiskey Galore being one of the greatest of the Ealing comedies.
Oh, they'll be doing Genevieve next, won't they?
I do hope not. I really hope not, but it wouldn't surprise me at all. Well, in that case, James...
Well, I will say, please go and see Heal the Living. It's way down the chart, but it is a transformative, very moving, brilliantly put together film, a French film with Emmanuel Seigneur and a lot of really good actors. I just was so moved by it. I might even say it was the best film of the year so far.
Oh, OK. Well, we're going to talk now about a release of a DVD. You talked earlier about Their Finest, which was a modern movie, but it's about the making of a propaganda film in the war. And I think you want to talk about Will Hay's penultimate film, which is The Goose Steps Out from 1942, which, of course, was a real propaganda movie.
Now, I have a confession to make. In spite of my decades of experience as a film reviewer, I have never, ever managed to see a film with Will Hay. And yet he was one of the top box office British stars of the 1930s and early 1940s. However, today he doesn't have the same recognition factor as his peers, largely, I think, because his humour hasn't dated that well. Now, you, I suspect, Simon, have seen a fair share of Will
Hay. I've seen almost all the Will Hay films that still exist, yes, I confess. I rather like him, very much indeed, yes. I mean, he of course, made Oh, Mr. Porter, which is probably the most famous of the films still left, which is, I would hazard, still a very, very good comedy. I haven't seen The Goose Steps Out, well, probably for 15, 20 years or more. But it's sort of, from what I remember, it's sort of like a British version of The Great Dictator, isn't it? It all to do with the resemblance between him and Hitler.
Indeed it is. And The Night We Dropped a Clanger, where Brian Ricks played a blithering idiot who was sent behind enemy lines as well. I will say from the outset that this is a beautifully restored print of the 1942 film, and it was a joy to see such young actors like Peter Ustinov in their pristine youth. It's marking the second directorial collaboration of Will Hay himself and the esteemed Basil Dearden, who was actually, he was born Basil Dear, but he changed his name because he was working alongside Basil Dean at the time, and people were getting confused. So he extended his name to Basil Dearden, and he went on to make some very fine films, including The Blue Lamp, which we reviewed fairly recently. This is a wartime farce about an inept teacher who happens to be the exact double.
In almost every film, Will Hay is a teacher. He's a lawyer in one, but almost every other film, it was his musical act. He was a teacher who was actually stupider than his pupils.
Ah, right. I think you know more than I do. Well, he's parachuted into Germany as a spy in order to find the secret of a new bomb that the Nazis are developing. And if you can believe this, then you will believe anything. Hay is his usual bumbling, shrill self. And the comedy about as broad as the Rhine. It's sort of lurching from knockabout farce to endless double takes and a lot of shouting. And the music! I couldn't believe I was actually watching this, because a lot of people really like this. And you probably have very fond memories of The Goose Steps Out. But it was so crude and silly, and the music, wah, 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 kept on going on. I thought, oh no, stop the music. I mean, the verbal wit for which Hay prided himself, and there is the talk of the fifth taking over the fourth before tackling the seven, talking about the Nazis sort of invading Britain, which was fairly funny, but it pales in comparison to what the two Ronnies pulled off over 30 years later. The production values are also laughable, and that bloody strident background music. I found it almost unbearably graceless to watch. I found it that bad. I hate to disagree with you again.
I'm awfully sorry to hear that, James. I will have to watch it again and see whether, you know, 20 years on, I still like Will Hay. I confess I have a
really
fondness for him anyway.
I have to say, it was sort of fun to see Charles Hawtrey play a member of the Hitler Youth, like a sort of eager boy scout from Hounslow.
Yeah. The bizarre thing about Will Hay is he was actually a very keen amateur astronomer. Something, I can't remember what it was, something like some spot on Saturn or something, something that he actually discovered. I think it may actually be that, a big white spot on Saturn. And he also taught, I can't remember, it was one of the early female aviators, Atrexes or whatever you call them, but he taught them to fly. Somebody like Amelia Earhart, he taught to fly. I'll have to look it up for next time.
Wow.
He was an extraordinary man.
I also know that he could speak French and German and Italian, and Norwegian, and Afrikaans, and Chinese.
I did not know that. Clearly, a man of many talents. And I suspect, but I don't know for sure, probably self-educated, but I may have that wrong. James, we're almost out of time. Have you got anything you want to talk about very, very quickly? Like, staggeringly quickly?
Yeah, I did want to... The casting news of the week for me was Margot Robbie has been announced to play Queen Elizabeth I opposite Saoirse Ronan in the film called Mary, Queen of Scots, marking the directorial debut of the National Theatre stage director Josie Rourke. The first thing I thought was, how many Australians are going to play Queen Elizabeth I in my lifetime?
Yeah, extraordinary. I must say, when I first encountered Margot Robbie on screen, that's not a role I would necessarily have suggested her for. James, Cameron Wilson, thank you. We'll be back with another Business of Film next week.
I want to be alone.
Mrs. Robinson, you're trying to seduce me. Aren't you?